Good morning. So last time we talked about some assembly topics. We talked about AT&T syntax. We mentioned, basically the syntax. We had one issue which kind of is not specific to AT&T syntax about what labels are. So labels in assembly, you sometimes have a name and a colon marking something, and then later on or in some other place you use that name. These are labels. And the way labels basically work is that as part of making the machine code, they act like the address of whatever the thing that is labeled is. And so as far as the syntax of assembly, they're kind of just treated like they were just numbers, the constants. Even though when you're writing the assembly, you might not know what the actual value of that will end up being when it gets finally made into an executable. We also talked about rules about overlapping registers. So x86, as you may remember from 2150, had REX, EAX, and so on, had these registers that are names for different parts of bigger registers. And we talked about how those worked, how they, we showed a chart of what their names are so you can look them up. And we mentioned that there's this special rule that when we write into a 32-bit one, it clears the rest of the 64-bit one. That's just an arbitrary choice some people at AMD made at some point in time. We talked about calling conventions. So calling conventions are just the rules we have for how function calls work. So these aren't things which are necessarily part of the instruction set. It's just that we needed to have some agreement that when I write a function, this is where I look for my parameters. These are the registers I use and so on. And we talked about what the Linux x86-64 convention was. We said, we use certain registers for the parameters. We have the return value in a certain register. And we also had to have rules about how other registers were used. And this, I think, is the point of the most confusion. So we have sort of two options when thinking about how registers should work with function calls. So one option is we can say that when you call a function, the function can do whatever it wants with the register, so you need to save it if you can. Those are caller-saved registers. Another option is that we can say that if you're writing a function, it's your job to make that register not change for whoever's calling you, because they might be using it. And in that case, you're going to save the value of the register while you're using it and restore the old value before you return. Those are callee saved registers. So these are two different options, and the people who made the Linux x86-64 calling convention could have said, we'll have all the registers be caller saved or callee saved, but like most people who've designed calling conventions in the past few decades, they didn't do that. They instead said, we're going to have some registers be in this caller-safe category, some in this callee-safe category as kind of a compromise between the advantages and disadvantages of both ideas. So questions about any of these topics? So, no questions apparently, wasn't that careful. Okay, so based on my preliminary look at the quiz earlier today, I thought I should go over some of the quiz questions. So, talk first briefly about the first quiz question. So the first quiz question was saying that a processor is executing this instruction, move parentheses RBX into REX. What does this instruction do? So, in AT&T syntax, REX is the destination, and parentheses was a special case of that general way of accessing memory, so this is accessing a memory location using the value of RBX as the memory location, and we don't have anything else in that computation of a memory address. So that's what the instruction means. So to execute this instruction, well, the processor already has RBX here. and it's going to ask what's at that address, it's going to get the value, and it's going to update RAX to have that value. A lot of people really wanted this update to use the bus, or didn't read the question really carefully. The question was asking, what updates does the processor have to talk to memory? The processor has these registers itself. It doesn't need to talk to the memory. And one way you can know that is that you can't make a pointer to a register. Right? It doesn't have an address you can use. So it's not part of the memory. There's no address we can send to the memory to get the value of REX or to set the value of REX. So questions about question one? Okay. So question two through four were basically about endianness. So we had this C snippet here. And this gave us this scenario. So X is this 4-byte number, and our memory only knows how to store things in 1-byte units. So that means that this 4-byte number that's stored in memory has to be divided up into 4 pieces. And those pieces are going to have different indexes in the memory, so I just marked them as, you know, the base plus 0, plus 1, plus 2, plus 3. And we learned that we're going to use little endian here. So that means to figure out what value is stored, well, we take our number here, 1077. This is C code, so that must be a decimal number. That's how C works. If it was not decimal, we have to have it written differently in C. So if I convert that to hexadecimal, it's 435. Or I can write that out with a bunch of leading zeros to show all of the 32 bits of the number, as it's going to be stored in our 4 bytes. And I need to divide up those 32 bits into, you know, the 4 bytes. So I'm going to get, you know, 4 parts doing the division in the logical way. And I need to put each of those 4 parts in one of the 4 slots. And little endian tells us the rule for which part goes in which slot. It says the least significant part goes in the slot with the lowest index. So the plus 0 part gets the 3-5 byte, because that's with a little endian. I also had a pointer to this at a different memory address, but that, for the most part, doesn't come up beyond knowing that this is at 50,000. A note I'd like to make about endianness is some people really want to use endianness a lot of places. Endianness is only something that's going to come up when we have this case where we have a bunch of small slots that we can access independently. So the reason we need to know about what goes in this slot versus this slot is that these slots have different numbers. We don't really have this problem when we're writing down numbers. I'm always going to write down numbers in the way we expect in English, which is that, you know, if you see this number here, that the least significant part is always going to be on the right, and the most significant part is always going to be on the left. Just because that's how we write them in English, or in C, or and so on. But where we care about endianness is when we have to make this decision that, oh, I have these different parts that I can access independently. Right? With the memory, you know, I can write code that tries to access this particular byte. And we need to know what that's going to do. This doesn't come up not only with written numbers, but with registers, because I can't write code to access the second part of EAX. I can write code to access AX, but we already know that's the least significant part, because that's how AX is defined. It's not defined as part 2. So endianness only comes up when we have these numbered pieces, like with the memory. So questions about 2 through 4. Okay. Finally, we had this last quiz question. So here we have this C code where we had an array of characters represented by a pointer to that array, and we were trying to do a lookup at index x plus 2, x is some variable, plus 2, and get the result into a character C. And the desired operation was to set C to memory at the address string, so the base of the array, plus x, plus 2, and these were stored in particular registers. And we have two examples which were correct. So we had this first one where we took 2, put it in a temporary, added x to the temporary, and then set c to memory at string plus the temporary times 1, because that's what this syntax here means, base plus index times scale. And if we expand what the temporary is, this is 2 plus x times 1, string plus 2 plus x times 1, which matches with this expression up here. So that was correct. We had a second example where we had x in the temporary, became, we added 2 to it, so we got x plus 2, and then we accessed memory at x plus 2 plus string times 1, which is still equivalent to this expression. And I think this confused a few people because you remembered, oh, wait a moment, the way this works is we have a base, an index, and a scale. And you said, oh, but string is not an index. And, well, that's true, but from the processor's perspective, the processor's just doing some arithmetic. Yes, the arithmetic has sort of an intended purpose, but the processor doesn't care. What it's actually being used for is just going to compute the address, and if it's the right address, it's going to work. If it's the wrong address, it's not. And multiplying by 1, adding and multiplying by 1, doesn't matter what order we do it in, so it computes the same address. And we have this last example, which confused a bunch of people. So we have store 0 in a temporary, and then we do this add instruction to add to that 0 memory at string plus x plus 2. So it matches this address. So we've retrieved the right value. And we've done it by adding it as an 8-byte value. So we've retrieved 8 bytes from the correct location, not 1 byte, but we've put that in the temporary variable. And then we move the temporary variable to this 1-byte thing. So I think many of you said, oh, okay, so we're moving from the temporary to a 1-byte thing, so we're just extracting that 1 byte, great. Unfortunately, that's not quite what this move instruction does, because we have these parentheses here. We're accessing memory at a location specified by the temporary variable. So we're using the value retrieved from the character array as an address. Probably isn't a good address. So that's probably not going to work. It's probably going to crash. Now, it's true we could have used the value in R8 to do this correctly, but that wouldn't involve accessing memory again. We don't use it as an address, we just want to extract the bottom part of it, which we could have done with something like move R8BBL. If you remember from our table of the overlapping register parts, R8B is the name for the least significant 8 bits of R8. But that's not what this does. The code we have here actually tries to access memory again, but there's no reason that it's the valid memory address. So questions about any of these examples here? Go on to talking about, mentioned we had similar for the last time, LEA. So LEA stands for load effective address. It's probably an instruction you saw in 2150, which I know a lot of people have been confused about for a while. So let's start with its name. It said load effective address. What's an effective address? It's a computed address, you know, from the middle of writing an instruction. So, for example, if RAX is 1,000 and we do move RAX, and let's say RCX is 200, 200 hex, if we do move RAX, RCX, into RDX, the effective address is the result of this address computation, which would be the sum of RAX and RCX. So the effective address is just a name for if we're ever executing an instruction, often we have to like compute a memory address to do that. The memory addresses we compute to do that are effective addresses. So the load effective address instruction, we compute that address, and then rather than actually accessing memory with it, we just load it into the destination register. Another way we can look at it is that it's like the address of operator, the ampersand operator in C, that we have our source and we take the address of it. Questions? Yeah.
What's the last register
that... Oh, it's RDX. Okay. It doesn't matter because it's not part of the effective address. No matter what it is. What that last register is. So as an example here, if we had move queue for RAX, this would load from memory at 4 plus RAX into RAX. With LEA, we compute 4 plus RAX and just store it in the result. So we end up with that this instruction adds 4 to RAX. So it does the address computation, and we're thinking of as the address of operator, we're taking the address of this here, this that expression which remember means memory at RAX plus 4, and we're taking that address, which is RAX plus 4, and putting it at RAX. So this is basically the same as adding 4 to RAX. I'll talk about why I say basically, but there's something we're going to learn about later today, which explains why it's slightly different than the add instruction. But for the most part, it's extremely similar to just adding 4 to RAX. Okay, so questions? Yes? Is it faster than adding 4 to RAX? That's complicated. We might talk about that. I think the answer is mostly no, but it's complicated, yeah. Yes?
Okay. So the load is to access the address of memory of RAX plus 4, but the add is adding the value of RAX.
The question, the load is accessing the address of memory of RAX plus 4? So that's how I would understand, you know, why it's written this way. But the address of memory of RAX plus 4 is the same as RAX plus 4,
but
right?
But RAX plus 4 is like the value of RAX plus 4.
Question, the RAX plus 4 is the value of RAX plus 4? Yes. But if we think of accessing memory at address X, and what the address of that is, it's X. So like the memory access cancels out with the address of it. And that's how we get this plain add. So we end up just doing arithmetic. We don't actually do anything with memory. And I think this is where this causes the most confusion, is that you might say, okay, so, you know, this is like an add, but we have to do it with a memory address. That's not how it works. The processor doesn't access memory, so it doesn't care if RAX plus 4 isn't a valid memory address. It's going to compute RAX plus 4. It's not going to do anything with memory with it. It's just going to put in its result. So you can use this to just do a computation on something that isn't an address. And the compiler likes to do this. You might say, why would the compiler like to do this? We have these more straightforward instructions, add and multiply and so on. Why would I use this funny instruction that's clearly not intended for doing just normal arithmetic with not addresses? And well, it turns out that it's on x86, it's one of the more convenient ways to do certain kinds of arithmetic. So I have an example here. So this is LEA REX, REX, 4. And if you remember our rules for how memory accesses work, this expression here is memory at a base plus index times scale. Our scale is 4, our index is REX, our base is REX, so this is REX plus REX times 4. Does that make sense as a memory address? Probably not, but that's what the rule for how we compute addresses, like for move, tells us to compute. So we're going to compute that. And we're going to take the address of that, so we're not actually going to access memory, we're just going to end up computing memory at REX times 5. The address of that is REX times 5. So we end up computing REX times 5. So this instruction is a way to multiply by 5. And at least on some processors, it's probably a lot faster than using the multiply instruction to do that. And so the compiler likes generating that. So questions? Yep. How did I get the 5? So this is REX times 1 plus REX times 4. We use the distributive rule. So this is REX times 1 plus REX times 4, or REX times 1 plus 4. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So we have this funny way of multiplying RX times 4, and this is in fact, often compilers will generate this thinking it's probably faster to do than using an actual multiply instruction. Similarly, I have this LEA instruction here, which does RBX plus RCX, because base plus index. We don't have a scale here, so the scale defaults to 1. So it's RBX plus RCX times 1, RBX plus RCX, and it puts the result in RDX. So why would a compiler want to do this, or would I, writing assembly by hand, want to do this rather than using an add instruction? What would be the difference if I just used an add instruction instead? How would I write this instead with an add instruction? Yeah?
Would it take 2 lines to do with an add instruction?
What would the extra line be from? Because you only have one of those sort of spines. So what would the extra line be?
Should it be like move
Okay. Yeah, so you're saying that, okay, if I want to do this with an add instruction, I need to copy into RDX first. Because my add instruction only takes 2 operands, and then I can add the value in RDX. So I've saved an instruction because this LEA instruction lets me specify 3 different registers. And the compiler might like taking advantage of that. Even though it seems otherwise a convoluted way of adding 2 numbers when we have an add instruction. So questions about these sort of LEA examples and why a compiler might prefer them to the more straightforward versions? So let's do a little exercise here. So here I have a function called mystery. I have the C code for it here, and I generated this presumably by just writing code like this and putting something in the dot 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 here. Now to understand functions, we need the calling convention. I told you I wouldn't have you memorize the calling convention, so let's show the relevant parts. So the first argument in our calling convention is going to be an RDI, or EDI, or DI, or so on, depending on the size of the argument, if it's 64, 32, and so on. And the return value is going to be an RAX or EAX or AX or so on, depending on the size. That's what our calling convention says. And there's something else we have going on here, which is we have this LEA L instruction, and we have a 32-bit result. You might say, wait a moment, addresses are 64 bits. How can we have load effective address have a 32-bit result? And it turns out there is that version of the instruction. And what it does is it computes a 64-bit address, which is why this part of the instruction uses RDI, and just truncates it down to 32 bits, the result. Yes?
How exactly do you truncate the 64-bit address to a 32-bit?
Question, how exactly do I truncate from 64 to 30 bits? Well, so when I say truncate, I mean we discard the extra bits, as opposed to something like, you know, rounding or something like that. Does that answer your question? Okay. So the question is, what goes in the dot, dot, dot here? I'll give you a minute or two or three to figure that out. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so he thinks it's A, B, C, D, E, F. Okay, so most people got E, which is great. So let's go through what's going on here. So this does 0 plus base, which is omitted, so 0, plus our index, which is RDI, which is arg, times 8, which is the scale, goes into EAX, which is our destination. So EAX is arg times 8. And then we have the subtract instruction. The way subtract works is to subtract from. So this is going to compute EAX gets EAX minus EDI. EDI is arg. EAX from the previous instruction is arg times 8. So this is arg times 8 minus arg, which is going to give us arg times 7. So it's positive arg times 7. A complaint people might have is, wait a moment, how is the argument just int, but then we're using RDI here? So the compilers here has taken advantage of the fact that when we set EDI, we must have set RDI. Because remember, setting the E registers clears the rest of the 64-bit register. So we don't have to worry about any extra junk in RDI. Yes?
Just wondering about the convention. When you're working with stuff like blocks, would you want to use like the E registers instead of purposely using the R register?
When you're working with stuff like longs, would you want to use the E register instead of purposely using the R register? For longs, which are 8 bytes on x86-64 Linux, you'd want to use the R registers because they're 8 bytes. But if you're working with ints, which is what our code here does, you'd want to use the E registers generally because they're 32 bits, which is the size of an int. Is that? Question, so people wouldn't actually write the LEA command like that. So why did the compiler or whoever generated this code, you know, use RDI instead of EDI? And the reason is that for computing addresses, we have to compute an 8-byte address, which means we had to use RDI here. So even though we don't actually care about the upper 32 bits because it's not really an address, the instruction is still written as if it is an address, so that's why we had to use RDI. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah? Question, you thought LEA was loading an address to the EAX, is it not? So, we're doing the computation we do for addresses here. So we're interpreting this as an address long enough to compute a number. That is an address, or could be an address, but we're not actually using it as an address, we're just putting it in EAX. Does that answer your question? So we still have, the effective address comes from, we're doing an address computation, we're just maybe not, may or may not be using it as an address. Follow-ups? Okay. So I'm going to finish up by covering one more topic in assembly. There's some things I wanted to mention exist that we won't really cover, or we'll cover later. So one is that floating point is a thing. Like floats doubles, we don't actually know how to do any of that. We're not going to really talk about it. There's also something called vector operations. So there's instructions that work on multiple values at once. We are going to talk about that later in the semester. These use some special registers you might see in assembly that you are XMM0 through XMM15. There's also a feature called segmentation that we're going to kind of skip over because it's mostly historical, that uses special registers DS, FS, and GS that you might see. And also, x86 has a whole ton of instructions that, you know, I don't expect anyone to memorize, because there's like thousands of them, literally. You know, we'll look them up when we need them. We're not going to like have you go through all of them. And there's certainly going to be instructions that, you know, you'll come across that you know, you won't have C. So our second topic for the day is going to be about conditionals. So from 2150, you, I assume, wrote code in assembly that did stuff like if statements. And sort of the way we would take this if statement here, if REX is not equal to 0, call foo, is we'd compare REX and 0 and do a conditional jump to skip the call in this case. And something we have to answer, because it's going to come up when we build our own processors, is how does this jump if equal instruction know about the compare? So you kind of treated, probably, the compare and conditional jump instruction as like a pair, but we could put things in between here. They're just separate instructions. So like, what happens if I say, you know, change the value of REX here? That, what does that do to the jump if equal? We're going to answer that question by answering, well, where does jump if equal get the result of the comparison? It has to be somewhere. Where is it? And the answer is that there's some special extra registers called condition codes. And that's how jump if equal is getting the result of a comparison. And the condition codes store information about the last result of arithmetic. You might be like, wait a moment. You told me it was for comparisons. Why are we talking about arithmetic? And it turns out that these condition codes are set by a lot more than the compare instruction. But what they store is they store information about the last result of arithmetic of that arithmetic instruction. You might say, wait a moment. But compare isn't arithmetic. What are they storing for the comparisons? It turns out that the compare instruction is doing arithmetic and setting the condition codes based on that. We'll talk about exactly how that works later, but the preview is that it's a subtract. So the conditional jump instructions, they read the condition codes, which are about the last result of arithmetic, and they're named based on interpreting it as the result of subtraction, or alternately of comparing it to zero. So jump if equal is saying, if the last result was zero, jump. Jump if less than is saying, if the last result was negative, then jump. And so on. So they're named, sort of interpreting that as the result of the comparison. As well as subtraction, which makes the comparisons work. Because if we subtract two numbers and get zero, they're equal. So that's why that works. Now, you might say, okay, so it's based on the last arithmetic result, so we must have a hidden register that stores the number that was computed by the last piece of arithmetic. And that's not what we actually do. We store something simple. We store a handful of bits. And the two main ones, and the ones we're going to implement later on when we have assignments to make a little processor, are the zero flag and the sign flag. So these are one-bit sort of hidden registers. The zero flag is set to one if the result is zero, and zero otherwise. So this is what jump if equal checks, because if we subtract two values and they're zero, get a zero, they're equal. There's also the sign flag, which tells us if the result is negative. You might say, why is it called the sign flag? So if you remember your two's complement, the most significant bit in two's complement sometimes is called the sign bit. The sign flag's just a copy of that bit. When the sign flag's one, the number was negative, otherwise it's positive. So jump if less than is checking if we had a negative result. So we track two things. One's bigger than the other, and negative, plus some stuff for overflow. So question so far, sign flag and zero flag. So if we didn't have to worry about overflow, this would be enough to handle our comparisons, but we have some other overflow and also sign this to worry about. So x86 is two other important condition codes. which I'm going to talk about briefly, but we're going to mostly gloss over them, partly because we're not going to have you implement them just to make the processor simpler, that we're going to have you build later on. But I want you to know they exist. So there's the overflow flag, which says, if we treat this as a signed computation, did it overflow? And this is used by jump if less than, jump if greater than, and so on. They check this to see, you know, if the sign of the result was wrong. If we subtracted two numbers and, you know, got a positive number when it really should have been negative or vice versa, for example. But overflow, it depends on whether you treat things as signed or unsigned. So the overflow flag says, assuming the subtraction was signed, did it overflow? We also have a carry flag, which is assuming it was unsigned, did it overflow? And you may see some conditional instructions that are for unsigned comparisons, like jump below is the unsigned version of jump less than. And the way they work with the condition codes is we do the same computation, but we look at whether it was correct for signed or unsigned depending on which version of the conditional jump you use. So jump below is going to say, you know, did this overflow as unsigned versus signed? So questions? These flag registers. So these are going to be 1-bit extra registers, and you can in fact see these values in the debugger. So if you type info registers in GDB, one of the things it outputs is this eFlags register, and this contains all the flags encoded, all the condition codes, and some other things called flags, I should say, encoded in this bits. And GDB outputs in this sort of allegedly human readable field the ones that are sent. So here we can see the zero flag is set, and two other flags we didn't talk about, one of which is the parity flag, which is another condition code that we're not going to care about in this course, and something that's not a condition code, but is another flag. And since the sign flag, the overflow flag, and the carry flag were shown, they must be set to zero. So questions? Here, yes.
So if one flag is set, like technically all of the registers are, or is that just for the zero flag?
The question, if one flag is set, would so this register here, this eFlags register, includes all of these in different bits of it. So there's this one number which encodes all the flag values. And what the debugger is telling us here is that the zero flag is set along with these other two flags, the parity flag and the interrupt flag. And it doesn't list SF, OF, and CF, so they must be encoded as not being set based on this information.
Oh no, I was asking, so for the zero flag, if it's set to one, everything else has to be clear. So is that the same for other flags or just the zero flag?
Oh, question. If the zero flag is set to one, everything else has to be clear. That's not the case. That's not what this is trying to say. This is saying, based on reading this out, the zero flag is set and the others are clear. If, for example, I read out the debugger told me PF, ZF, SF, IF, that would mean the zero flag and the sign flag were set, but since CF and OF aren't listed, they must be clear. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's look at some examples of using condition codes. So here I load REX with negative 10. I add RBX, I load REX with 20, and I subtract REX from RBX to get 30. So I'm doing a 20 minus negative 10 gives me 30. So that result is positive and not zero. So here, the zero flag is going to be zero, because it's not zero. And the signed flag is going to be 0 because it's not negative. And that's the information jump if less than equal is going to look at, and it plus overflow, but that doesn't matter in this case, to determine that it's not going to jump to foo. Questions? How this works. And we have other versions of that. So for example, if I have RAX is 20 and RBX is 20, I'll subtract and get a result of 0. And the sign flag will be 0 because that's not negative. And jump if less than or equal, well, it will jump because it will see the 0 flag is 1. Therefore, if you think of a compare, that would have been equal. So it will jump. And if I have a result that's negative, so here I have, I subtract 0 from negative 10, get negative 10. I get a result that's negative. This jump less than or equal will be taken because the sign flag is 1. Okay, so questions about these examples of what condition codes are and how jump less than or equal uses them? Okay, so I've shown these examples with subtract, but as I mentioned, we typically use compare. So compare is does a subtraction and just forgets to store the result. So in these examples, we actually modified RBX. If I replaced the subtract with a compare, the jump would act the same, but RBX wouldn't be changed by the subtraction. So the compare is just a subtraction that forgets to store the result, but it still sets these flag registers. There's also another instruction you might see the compiler use called test, which does a bitwise AND. We'll talk next week about what bitwise AND is. And the most common way you'll see this is it will do test REX, REX. It turns out when you bitwise AND something with itself, you get itself. So this is using REX to set the condition codes. So for example, the most common way you'll see this is something like test RAX, RAX, and then say jump if equal to foo, and this is going to be jump if foo equals 0, because remember, the conditional jump instructions are named after comparing to 0, and the thing we're comparing, checking is RAX, so it's RAX 0, then go to foo. Yes?
Do you mean like RAX?
Sorry, REX is 0. Yes, I wrote the wrong thing. If REX 0, because this test is the set condition codes using REX as the value we're basing it on. I didn't write that in a possible to read one. Other questions? So, mention that most arithmetic sets the condition codes. Let's be more specific about that. So, we have most instructions that can do things set condition codes. Compare is like subtract, except it only sets condition codes and doesn't do anything else. Test is like AND, except it only sets condition codes and doesn't do anything else. And there are some instructions that don't change the condition codes at all. And some of these are obvious, like jump, what would it set the condition codes to? Some of these are less obvious. So LEA, we learned, is used to do computations. Move computes an address. Turns out that we've made the decision, the designers of the instructions have decided that these instructions shouldn't actually change the condition codes, even though, yes, they do some computation. If you want to know what instructions set the condition codes, you read the manual. That's the ultimate source. You can make an educated guess based on that pattern, but there's exceptions. And, you know, corner cases, so like LEA, you could make an argument it should, but it doesn't. If you think of like push, like it computes an address on the stack, should it set the condition codes with that? They've decided not. That's how you do. And this not setting the condition codes is why I said that LEA that I showed you earlier was very similar to an add, but it's not the same. This is one reason why. Okay, so we have our example we can change to compare. And this is going to not jump, but it's also not going to change the value of RBX from 20. It's still going to be 20. It's not going to be 30, even though that's the number we compute here. Because remember, the compare is just a subtraction that forgets to store the results. Okay. And you might say, why did the designers of the Intel instruction set decide to have the condition codes be set by all these arithmetic instructions? Why is that useful? And to kind of illustrate probably the sort of thing they were thinking of, here I have a loop that counts from 99 down to 0. And sort of the most straightforward way of writing it is I start with 99, I subtract until I get 0, and you know, check if it's 0 and go back to the beginning of the loop. It's not, if it's not negative yet. I can rewrite that as just subtracting and doing the conditional jump right after, because it turns out that, remember, the conditional jump is compared with the result to 0, so it just works. Don't need that extra comparison. I think this is the sort of pattern they had in mind when they had all the arithmetic instructions set the condition codes, is that you could come up with cases like this where you just save a compare instruction anyways, and it's relatively easy to make the processor set those flags all the time. If you can set them for the compares, the same circuit can do it for every other instruction. Some questions about this simplification? Okay, so let's do an example here. So here I have some assembly code. And I want to know about what's going to be the condition codes after this runs, and let's assume no overflow happens. Who'd like some more time? Let's see if anyone. Okay, so who thinks A is possible? Okay, I think a majority thinks B is possible. Okay, C. D. No clue. Okay, so we have a lot of consensus on A and B. So the way I worked through this is I said, okay, so D, so I called the initial value of RCX C, so I said D, which I'll call what RDX is for shorthand, becomes C, first instruction. Second instruction is the second version of D, so D prime becomes D minus 1, which is the same as the initial C minus 1. And then C prime, the second version of C, is C plus D prime, RDX we just set with the subtract. And then that becomes 2C minus 1. And this is what sets our condition codes. You might say, wait a moment, aren't the condition codes set by the first subtract? Absolutely. And then they're overwritten. So it's only the second instruction that gives us our actual condition codes. And we get 2C minus 1. And for the zero flag, we want to answer the question, can that be zero? So I say 2C minus 1 equals zero. If I solve this, I get C has to be 1 half, and that's not possible because our registers only hold integers. So that eliminates C and D. Now there's something a bit tricky with the sign flag. So let's go through some examples to try to get the number. So let's say C is zero. So in that case, I'd be setting D to zero. Then I'd be setting D prime to zero minus one, which would be negative one. You would say, okay, that's fine, but I kind of omitted some information here. I didn't tell you what kind of values I was interpreting RCX and RDX as. So if RCX and RDX are like longs, that's fine. Longs can hold negative one. If they're unsigned longs, that's not good. That's overflow. That we get, as an unsigned number, we got this huge value, doesn't make sense. So assuming no overflow and RCX, RDX are signed numbers, then the answer is A and B. If we assume that they're unsigned, then it's a little more problematic, a little trickier. So if we assume they're signed numbers, then we get negative one here, and if we keep going, we get zero plus negative one is negative one, or two times zero minus one. So we can get a negative result, that's B. So an example is with, you know, RCX equals zero, and we can get something where the sign flag is zero. That is, we get a positive result if we like start with C as 1,000 or something like that. Some questions? So that I sneakily didn't specify if these were signed or unsigned computations, and it kind of matters to know if we think overflow is occurring or not. But other than that, the big thing was figuring out that zero was an impossible result. Yes? Do sub-Q and add-Q only work on integer values? Yes. The main reason you know this is because the registers we're supplying hold 64-bit numbers. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's do other things. So we talked about how the condition codes are set. Let's talk about how they're used. So jump greater than or equal to, which of these is it checking for? And I want a single answer, not multiple answers. So if you think it's checking for ZF equals one and something else, you should not choose A. Give you a minute. check with your editors. See what you think. And okay, who would like some more time? Okay, who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so you have a split between D and M. So the way I remember the conditional jump instructions is I think about them comparing to zero, which is the same as what we expect, how we had it with compare. So jump greater than or equal to is, are we saying if the last result was greater than or equal to zero? And our last result, we used to set SF and ZF. ZF was set if the result was zero, and SF is set if the result was negative. So you might look at A and say, oh, when ZF is one, we want to jump. When it's zero, if we subtract two round numbers and get zero, we want to jump on jump greater than or equal. So ZF is one is a case where you would jump, but it's not the only case. If we get a one, a positive number, we also want to do that. And that's going to have a sine flag of zero and a zero flag of zero. So what we actually want to check for is E, that this is non-negative is what this is checking for. So if we have a non-negative result, we want to jump. So I guess points of confusion. So D is not correct because this says we jump if we had a negative result. It's not what jump greater than or equal to is checking for. Checking for a positive result, not a negative one. And we don't actually care about the zero flag because when the sine flag is zero, that's enough for us to know it's not negative. And we don't care if it's zero or one, so we don't actually need to check the zero flag to distinguish between different non-negative cases. Questions about how I figured that out? So it's SF equals zero. Do we just care if it's not negative results of our whatever last arithmetic was, which is usually the subtraction for compare? Okay. So we have our comparison and conditional jump instructions. And I'm going to review briefly what I hopefully review. So what I do for converting from sort of C control flow to assembly, which presumably you did some version of in 2150, I'm not sure exactly how they do it there, just gonna show you what I like doing. So I have this C code here, and I went to write assembly for it. What I like doing is I like first translating this to C code that uses if go to and go to. So what I said here is, okay, so for the first instruction, I wanna skip over this A plus equals 10 sometimes, so I write, make a label that goes to where I want to skip to, and write an if go to statement that way. This is actually valid C, C has GoTo. Don't recommend using it, but it has it. And the reason I like writing code like this is because I can look at that line and I can say, oh, to translate that to assembly, that's compare conditional jump. Notice that to do this, I had to flip the condition because I want to skip over A plus equals 10 instead of going to A plus equals 10. So I reversed the condition. Similarly, after A plus equals 10, you want to skip over this times. So I have this go to here, I added to do that. Questions on sort of my process for converting this C into C that's more like the assembly I'm going to produce? Okay, so I have this C that's like the assembly I'm going to produce, and then I can just go line by line and write the assembly. So I say I have that. If go to, I convert that to compare jump less than. And I convert the add to the plus equals to an add instruction, the multiply to an imol instruction, and so on. Questions about this? Okay, so let's do an exercise in the other direction. So I have some code here. And my question is, which if any of these C snippets is it the same as? And we can go through the instructions here. So here we have rbx gets rbx minus rax. Our second instruction is rcx gets rcx plus rbx. And this, then we have a if something go to after, and then rcx gets rcx plus rax. So the main question is, what does that if go to translate to in sort of more natural C? I guess to be more specific about what this something is, we know it's the last result, and its jump equal is equal to zero. So whatever last result is. Okay, who'd like some more time? A couple people? Okay. Okay, so who thinks A is the same? Okay. B, C, okay. D, none of them, no clue. Okay, so we have a big split, and the answer is none of these. A is very close, but A flipped the comparison. So I think there was a bit of confusion about C. So the thing to remember about C is that you thought, oh, this is the operation we were doing, which it was, but we stored the result in RCX already. So it's the new RCX is what we're checking if it's zero. Now we're checking if it's zero, but we're not checking if it's zero and then doing this second add. We're checking if it's zero and then not doing the second add. So the comparison direction is flipped. And one reason I show this sort of flip comparison is that this is the most common error I see when people are working with conditionals in assembly, is that they'll try to translate it to if or loops, and they'll flip the direction of the comparison because they're not being careful. And the way I like figuring that out is by sort of writing out the sort of pseudo-C, where it's usually easier to figure out, wait a moment, it's equal zero skip, not equal zero do it. In my last minute, so just, we're gonna catch up on some things. So just mentioned briefly that we can apply the same idea to translating loops. Talk more about that next time. There's one topic I wanna talk about before you do start the homework, which is about compiling switches. So we talked about, you can do this with loops, you can do the same sort of translation. With switches, it's less obvious. What does it translate to? And then it turns out compilers have lots of different strategies. And I'm going to talk about three strategies, all of which are things compilers might do. So one thing is they might turn it into basically like a series of if statements. They'll do a compare, jump, compare, jump, compare, jump. Kind of like a bunch of if else, how you do that. Another thing they might do is a binary search. They'll say, compare to 50, have some code for the first half of the switch, compare for the second half of the switch. And a third option, which I'm mentioning because if you don't know about this, you'll be confused when you see it, is that the compiler can make a table of pointers to the code for each case and do an array lookup in that table and jump there. So what happens here is we have this instruction as a table lookup, and the compiler's made a table of the addresses of the code for case for, you know, if the switch variable is 1, 2, and so on. And based on the value of REX, our switch variable, it will jump to the right thing. So questions about that? I know I'm out of time. So next time we'll talk a little about, go through a little bit about converting loops to assembly, and then talk about object files, and generally more about how we create executables out of assembly files.